We interrupt this program to bring you an important Wayfair message. Wayfair's got style tips for every home. This is Nicole Byer, helping you make those rooms flyer. Today's style tip, when it comes to making a statement, treat bold patterns like neutrals. Go wild! Like an untamed animal print area rug under a rustic farmhouse table from Wayfair.com. Ooh, fierce! This has been your Wayfair style tip to keep those interiors superior.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Hi, this is Jen Rubin, and this is Jen Rubin's Green Room. As we record this on Tuesday, the war in the Middle East, or wars in the Middle East, depending upon your perspective, have gotten hotter. Iran is launching its missiles at Israel. Israel is at least temporarily rolling into Lebanon, and we are once more facing an expansion of what was simply a war against Hamas in Gaza. Now, all this sounds very bad, and it is, and we certainly hope that people remain safe, that we don't have more casualties. But I must say, at some point, you do have to change the equation there, and that's what Israel is trying to do. It is degrading Hezbollah to a point in which it is practically useless. That is a huge blow to Iran, which has built up Hezbollah as its agent, as its ally, as its surrogate in the region. And that's one of the reasons that Iran is now lashing out at Israel. It has to let the region know, whoa, look, we're still powerful. We're still Iran. Hezbollah can take a hit, but Iran remains strong. Well, we'll see. We'll see what the result of their launch is. Last time they tried this, they didn't get very far. Israel was able to blow up virtually all of its missiles. So God willing, there will be few, if any, casualties. We are also sitting here awaiting the vice presidential debate. And I am here to let you in on a secret. It doesn't matter. Nope. There are all kinds of newspapers and pundits and TV folks saying, oh, this is very important. This is more important than usual, because, of course, usually it's not important at all. I got news for you. It's not important. Think about this. What individual out there is going to say, oh, I was going to vote for Kamala Harris, but really, J.D. Vance just convinced me to go vote for Trump. Not going to happen. And conversely, imagine a person who's going to vote for Donald Trump and suddenly says, oh, that Tim, he seems like a nice guy. I'm going to vote for their side. It doesn't happen. I'm not saying you shouldn't watch it or it's not useful for the public to see the person who's going to be a heartbeat away from the presidency. But this constant need to make everything so important, everything determinative as a way of driving ratings, clicks, eyeballs, it's misleading and it probably makes you too nervous. So watch it, don't watch it. We'll tell you about it after the fact. And I imagine that Trump is going to think his side won, no matter how disastrously J.D. Vance does. Now, something else is going on, of course, and that is this massive natural disaster caused by the hurricane. Now, I will point out that extreme weather is wiping out the very people who keep telling us that climate change is a hoax. The senators and the congressmen from these states are the very people who oppose every effort to mitigate climate change, which is responsible for this increased intensity in hurricanes. Warming the earth, warming the water makes the hurricanes more intense. And that's why we get the storm of the century. And every year we get one that's even more destructive than the last. Now, this is not to say we shouldn't bail these people out. Of course we should. And that is what the government is doing now. Donald Trump would have us believe that Biden is just like he is, that he's vindictive, that he isn't helping people. No, Biden doesn't operate that way. The Biden-Harris administration is deploying thousands of people. And the Republican governors of these states keep saying, we're getting great help. We talk to the president all the time. But Donald Trump's message is to spread fear, resentment, anger. He is trying to make those people think the only people who care about them are him and his cronies. And that's a lie. And it's a disastrous lie, pardon the pun, because it sets people against one another. It causes people to do desperate things. And the federal government, the state government, the local governments are doing what they need to do at this point. It will not be perfect. There will be glitches. There will be problems. There will be people who lose power for far too long. But within the confines of human capacity, we are rescuing those people. What I would like to see happen when we inevitably vote a large aid bill is put in some more climate change measures to communicate to these people that, yes, we will bail you out, but you have to start working on the problem, which is climate change. You can't keep voting against this stuff and only show up at our door when the storms destroy your homes. That's not what responsible people do. That's not what responsible states do. So let's see if that happens. Unfortunately, I fear it won't, that the Democrats, being the softies that they are, will simply give the aid without strings attached, and we'll be right back where we are right now next year. So, by the way, this is a really good example of why it is so dangerous to fire 50,000 public servants and replace them with Trump lackeys. You want people who are disaster experts. You want people who are weather experts in those jobs for exactly this type of work. You don't want someone who is a flunky of Donald Trump and knows nothing about anything. That's ridiculous. And think about this across the government, whether it's the EPA, whether it's FEMA, whether it's the EPA, all of these agencies, we depend upon people who know what they're doing. And Trump has no conception of people knowing what they're doing because he doesn't know what he's doing. And he doesn't understand what government actually does for people. So it's a perfect example of why it's so dangerous to put this guy back in office and why you need someone who's not only empathetic, but actually thinks government is a good thing. It's not that we need the biggest government or the smallest government. We need the best government. We need to make it do what we want. And that's a foreign concept to Republicans who have essentially given up on the whole concept of governance. So, God willing, we will get through this week with a minimal amount of casualties in the Middle East and a quick cleanup and rescue operation in our own country. But it is a reminder that competency matters, whether it's foreign policy competence, whether it's domestic policy competence. And if you vote for clowns and fools, government will not be there when you need it most. So you know what you need to be doing. You need to be out there making sure you're registered, your friends, relations are registered, and making sure they vote. Early voting is underway in a lot of states. You can use it. Make sure you vote now. That way your vote is banked. The campaign doesn't have to spend time chasing you to the polls. And if something happens on election day, you get sick, there's a big storm, it's okay. You've already voted. So get it done now if there's early voting in your state. With global warming and rising energy bills, finding the right temperature at night is a struggle we all face. It can make it so hard to fall asleep. But recently, I found a way to sleep in perfect comfort all night long. Whether you sleep too hot or even too cold, my secret is using thermoregulating, NASA-inspired, silver-infused bed sheets by Miracle Made. Their self-cleaning, antibacterial bedding even prevents 99.7% of bacteria, so they stay fresher 3 times longer. That means 3 times less laundry. Thanks to Miracle Made, you'll stop sleeping in bacteria that can clog your pores and lead to breakouts and acne. They even eliminate bad odors, so your bed always feels freshly made. Life is much more comfortable with clean and clean with Miracle. Their temperature-regulating, silver-infused fabrics were inspired by NASA to give you maximum comfort no matter what the weather is like outside. Just picture yourself getting a better night's sleep every night. Plus, Miracle Sheets feel soft and luxurious without the high price tag of other luxury brands. They feel even nicer than some bed sheets used by those five-star expensive hotels. So you'll feel like you're on vacation every time you get into bed. I imagine I'm in the south of France or the Caribbean, someplace lovely. So ask yourself, what part of dreamland will Miracle take you to? Miracle has a whole line of comfortable, self-cleaning bedding, pillowcases, and comforters. I know you'll love them. Now, how do you get them? Go to trymiracle.com/greenroom to try Miracle-made sheets today. And whether you're buying them for yourself or as a gift for a loved one, if you order today, you can save over 40%. And if you use our promo GreenRoom at checkout, you'll get 3 free towels and save another 20%. Miracle is so confident in their product that it's backed with a 30-day money-back guaranteed. So if you aren't 100% satisfied, you'll get a full refund. Upgrade your sleep with Miracle Made. Remember, go to trymiracle.com/greenroom and use the code GREENROOM to claim your free 3-piece towel set and save over 40% off. Again, that's trymiracle.com/greenroom to treat yourself. Thank you, Miracle Made, for sponsoring this episode. You can look for the link in the show notes. We're in the midst of an election that is, I think, central to who we want to be as an American people. We talk about the fate of democracy, but democracy is the form of government. And I would argue that freedom is the purpose of democracy. It's the best system for attaining freedom. But we have a problem with freedom, and that is a lot of people don't know what it is. And a lot of people have a mistaken conception of what it takes to be free. Well, fortunately for us, we have with us Timothy Snyder. Many of you listening to this will have read his very short but powerful primer on tyranny, which gives some direction to resisting tyranny. This, in some ways, his new book on freedom is a counterpoint to that. It tells us, what is this freedom thing and how do we get it and what are the mistakes we make about it? And I think it's absolutely central because really, there are two kinds of freedom that we're seeing presented in this election. One guy says, freedom is I get to keep all the stuff I want and you don't get any of it. That makes me free. And the other kind of freedom is, you know, we need to give people access to things that make them more free, that make them, shall we say, even happy. And that, interestingly enough, has a lot to do with Timothy Snyder's book. So I'm thrilled to have him. Welcome to the show, Tim.
Glad to be with you.
It is such a pleasure. I feel like your new book should come with a warning label. This requires thinking. It is a very deep philosophical book in a lot of ways. What prompted you to do a book of this nature that is really philosophical, metaphysical, rather than a straight political tract or a historic tract? Why this kind of book right now?
As you know, I don't control the right now. Like, I've been thinking about the freedom book for 6 or 7 years and writing for about 5. And I wrote more than 200 drafts. It's coming out, I think, at a good time. But, you know, I didn't just think of it and make it come out, as you understand very well. It partly had to do with the reaction to a book which maybe would be more familiar to folks, which is On Tyranny.
Yes.
On Tyranny is about defending stuff that you already have. And that's important sometimes. Like, there are times when you just have to dig in and keep what you have. But there's a larger question which people were asking me already when On Tyranny came out, which is, what exactly is this thing that we're defending? And then the next step is, if we succeed in defending, what are we going to build? What would be a good America? And so from that, I shifted to the question, which I think is the real question of what would a good America look like? What is this thing, freedom, that we're talking about so much? And then I think the only way to do that is actually to answer the question of freedom by starting with the concept. Like, we Americans toss this concept around, but we wear it out, we abuse it, we don't take it seriously. We killed it by overuse, and I think sometimes by conscious misuse or abuse. And so what I think we need to do is say, okay, here's what freedom is. And I think when you do that, and I hope we'll talk about this more, but when you do define what freedom is, you find a lot of the apparent contradictions and conundrums in American political life then fall away.
Yes.
And it becomes a lot clearer what we actually need to do.
You explain that freedom in many people's minds is thought as freedom from. But you make a very powerful case, in fact, that's most of what the book is, that freedom is a positive. What do you mean by negative and positive freedom? And how has negative freedom led us astray?
I mean, let's just start from like an emotional portrait of our country. When people talk about freedom, they're often angry. And that's a sign that something is very wrong. Freedom is a joyous idea. Freedom is a happy idea. Freedom is about all the good things in life and being able to choose among them and make them real and bring them into the world. Freedom is positive in that way. And it's also positive in that in order to become free people, we need help. We need parents, we need friends. And those parents and those friends, they need institutions, they need support. So a freedom only exists in free people, and free people only exist when the right conditions are there for them. So freedom is positive in the sense that it recommends the kind of policies which would allow us to be free. If you think of freedom as just freedom being free from stuff, then you never have to ask the question of who you are, like, and what freedom actually means to you. If you think freedom is just from stuff, then freedom is just about resisting, opposing. And sometimes you have to resist and oppose, but in the name of what is the important question? Like, the wall isn't the problem. The problem is that the wall is stopping people from doing what? The things we want to do, but we have to think about what those things are positively. And politically, negative freedom is a trap too, because if you're American and you're told, well, freedom is just about barriers, then you're told the barrier is the government. And then you're told the smaller the government, the more free you're going to be. Then you end up, A, never thinking about what you should be doing as a citizen, but B, you end up conceding the actual power in the actual world to a handful of oligarchs. And you find yourself not actually living in a free world, but in a world where a very small number of people are deciding, you know, what gets said, what gets thought, what gets done.
You lay out the components of freedom. You begin with sovereignty, mobility, and you go through the list. The last one I found was the most interesting and maybe the most apt, which is solidarity. This concept that you need others to be free. That's such a departure from how conservatives, libertarians define freedom. Talk to us a little bit about that concept of why we need each other, why solidarity is essential to freedom.
I'll raise you one. I'm going to do it in a conservative libertarian way.
Excellent. So, wow. I knew that we had the right guest.
So it's a conservative view to think that some things are right and some things are wrong.
Yeah.
And I think there's a right way to talk about freedom and that this is the right way. And it's a libertarian view to say that freedom is the value of values, which I think is correct. Freedom is the value of values because it's the thing, it's the condition in which we can choose among all the good things. All that's fine and good, but it's terribly abstract. The only way to think about freedom is in terms of free people, which is another conservative point, right? Burke was very concerned about abstract ideas of freedom and wanted to make sure that we started with the actual person and his or her actual living situation. And then our living situation is we're all born, we can all get sick, some of us can have children, we're all going to die, and you can go from there. But there are basic constraints, there's a basic shape to our life, right? And so creating free people, being free, has to take into account that shape of our life. And that's why freedom can't just be me against the world. In order to become me, I had help. I had parents, I had schools, I had friends, I had institutions. So in order to become that person who's resisting at the right time, there were all these positive forces that had to go into it. But the most fundamental point that one has to make, if you really care about being right about freedom, is the solidarity point, which I really appreciate you for bringing up. Nobody can become an individual by themselves. It's just not possible. You can make a painting of a guy standing on top of a mountain. Yes. But for that guy to get to the top of the mountain, there was teaching about mountaineering. There was somebody who fed him. There was somebody who breastfed him. There was a whole bunch of stuff in the background to make that possible. Our dominant understanding of freedom essentially comes from landowning, propertied men, perhaps men who own slaves. There's a whole lot of stuff in the background which allows that individual to be free. What we need to get to is a point where we can help one another be free without it just being one person with a lot of exploited people in the background. The negative freedom idea comes from there, because if I'm that one person, the only one who's going to liberate all those slaves or enfranchise those women is going to be the government. And so I define freedom negatively. Government, stay away. But if freedom is going to be for everybody, we have to define it positively. And just in practice, I'm now going to get to the nub of the question. Sure, we all want to be individuals, but to be an individual means knowing yourself. And knowing yourself is something that you cannot do by yourself. We all go through life with metaphysical bits of spinach between our teeth. And the only way that we can get ourselves out of that situation is by listening to other people. And we only listen to other people if we take them seriously as being people like ourselves.
I often think of the solidarity concept in contravention to this I built it kind of notion. It's kind of an arrogance that everything you became is your own, and therefore you've had no advantages, and therefore no one else should have any advantages. It seems implicit in that is almost an argument for inequality and a sort of supreme arrogance about one's own ability. This seems to have been sort of a problem throughout American history as various groups have had to liberate themselves. Talk to us a little bit about kind of the presumption of no help, the presumption of individuality without help, without a support system, without a government.
Okay. First, let me just note a kind of atmospheric thing about this. That belief set leads to sadism. It leads to people taking pleasure in denying other people good things. So a very wealthy person who in fact had the equivalent of a welfare state growing up, because that's what it means to be wealthy, says other people can't have the welfare state, right? Or somebody says, I didn't need it, therefore these people shouldn't have it. And then you deny it to them, to other people sadistically by your vote, but you end up also masochistically denying it to yourself, and everybody is less free. But it's an example of how when you're angry, when you're trying to cause somebody else pain, you're probably not a free person. That's probably not freedom that you're experiencing right then. You're probably caught in somebody else's story, which is not your story. And in America, that story is largely the one to which I referred. You imagine it comes from you're a plantation owner, you have slaves, there are women at your beck and call. Fine. In that situation, you can call that freedom for yourself. I think that's conceptually wrong, but at least it's not impossible to understand. But in the world we are now, if you know where you don't have those things and where you shouldn't have those things, it's not free to say, oh, well, the government shouldn't be doing all these things for other people. In our 21st century world, I mean, I think that 18th century, 19th century, 20th century parts, that racial strain is still very important, where a lot of white folks think, I'm the self sufficient entrepreneur, and therefore I'm never going to need healthcare or whatever stupid thought. And therefore other people shouldn't have it because they're not self-sufficient and they're just going to take advantage of it somehow. Like that is still with us. And that does come right out of slavery in my view. And it overlaps with the 21st century version, which is that I'm a Silicon Valley billionaire. I made all my money on the basis of things which were developed by the United States government using tax dollars. All of it, all of Silicon Valley is based on U.S. tax dollars and federal government projects. Wouldn't exist otherwise. From the transistor onwards, the whole kit and caboodle, all the money's been made on the frothy superstructure of stuff that U.S. tax dollars paid for. But nevertheless, I'm a self-made person, and like I should be able to do whatever I want, and I'm the only one who should have free speech or whatever. That's the 21st century version. And it's all fallacious. And I think the only way to handle, I mean, you can make fun of people and you can learn about history, and that's all important. But the reason I wrote the book is that I think these are conceptual problems.
Yes.
Yes. Like, these are extreme examples, but they're conceptual problems. Those people only became free because of other people. And that's true of everybody.
One of the elements of freedom that you outlined that seems so relevant today is factuality, mm-hmm. that you cannot be free if you're immune to, or there's confusion about reality, about facts. It's a theme you've written about before, because authoritarians are so adept at confusing mm-hmm. reality, or at the very least, having mm-hmm. this ability to confuse us as to what is truth, or if there is truth. Tell us a little bit about that and how that paralyzes both our political system, but also this larger issue of really empowerment, freedom.
Mm-hmm. Let me first continue the critique of negative freedom, because negative freedom, which is our American common sense, and which is what I'm trying to fight our way out of in this book, it treats freedom always as being against something, right? And it's very easy to slip, if that's what you think freedom is, to slip from I'm against the barrier to I'm against the government to I'm against other people, but also the truth itself. Because in negative freedom, it's just your impulses that sometimes bounce up against things. And the truth is hard. It isn't what you think. You know, the reason your kid is having problems at school might not be what you think. The reason why your favorite athlete got sent down to the minors may not be what you think. The reason why people at work didn't like your proposal, the truth sometimes isn't exactly what you want, right? But nevertheless, your ability to process facts and to deal with the truth is what makes you a sovereign person. It's a necessary thing for you to be free. And so part of negative freedom is that it ends up encouraging us to believe whatever we want to believe. And the things we want to believe, they're never stories. I mean, very rarely, almost never, are they our own stories, which is bad enough. They're usually somebody else's story. And when you're in somebody else's story, then you're not free. You're just a character. Somebody else is actually punching the keyboard and you're doing what they want you to do. Facts are true. So I have to start with this. I believe in truth.
Idea, which I approve of entirely.
I believe in truth. I believe it's hard to get to. There are various mechanisms, but it's worth pursuing. And we have to be able to take that. I think we have to start from that, because if we take the kind of middle position, like, well, I know that Vance and Trump are telling tales, but on the other hand, what is truth? The moment you take the what is truth, once you take that line, you're always going to lose to the people who have the better stories, the better platforms, the people who are more ruthless than you about making stuff up, the people who have better information about what manipulations work than you do. You're going to lose to them. And that's a big part of the story of American politics in the last 15 years. So you have to believe in it. And then you also have to ask, okay, what is it for politically? And the basic thing that it's for is self-defense. Because you're not, as a citizen, there will always be people who are better connected than you, or have more wealth than you, or hold office and you don't. But if we all accept that there's truth, then you can always make a case. You can say, hey, my water's polluted, or hey, that person is corrupt because this, or hey, you know, this is a less efficient way, or hey, that person's not paying taxes. But once there's no truth, you have no self-defense, right? You're just gone. You can't dig your heels in, because there's no ground to dig your heels into. And that, by the way, just to complete the thought, like, that's why we have freedom of speech, is for the least powerful people, not the most powerful people.
And of course, that's the only way in a democracy you hold leaders accountable, because if there are no facts, then it's just whatever he or she says it is.
Yep.
One of the other concepts that I found so fascinating, because I'm really gnawing at this bone, is the paradox of what you called inevitability and eternity, that we get into these habits of mind that are negative or a hindrance to freedom. Talk to us a little bit about those two, and then I want to come back and really dig into the inevitability, which I think is a huge problem in our fixing our American political system.
Yeah, I agree with you. So to do that, let me just say a word about how I think we ought to be thinking in time, because those are bad ways of thinking in time. I'm a historian who's written a philosophy book.
Yes.
But the time is very important in this book. And one of the ways we get stuck is that we don't see the richness of the past. And when you don't see the richness of the past, you don't see all the ways that the past could lead to all kinds of interesting futures. And so in US political discussions, we both fail to see some of the terrible things that could happen, but we also fail to see some of the wonderful things that could happen because we're not good at following the lines coming out of the past. And so history teaches you that there are these structures, but it also teaches you there's agency. You have responsibility, you have a certain amount of power. And if you see those structures, you can turn them, you can twist them, you can move them, you can live in them, and you can change things. But if you don't see the structures, you can't. You can't just say, I want something to happen and make it happen. You can only change politics on the basis of things that are already underway and by recognizing them. And that's history, but it's also responsibility, right? So history plus responsibility would be the good concepts for me. The politics of inevitability is the idea that something else is going to do the work of democracy or freedom for you. And there are left-wing versions of this, there are right-wing versions of this, but what it comes down to is the notion that something else out there, like the founding fathers or the economy or history itself, is doing the work of freedom. And that is, be clear, that's an inherently authoritarian idea because the only person who can make you free is you. You can think about what structures will make you more free and work for those structures. But if you think something outside, some larger force is making you free, you're choosing unfreedom. And so the dominant version of this, I think, there was the Reagan version, which is the market's going to make you free. There's the Obama version, which is the arc of history, right? There is no arc of history. There's just history and there's just us. But what that does to you is that it tames you. Because you think that, well, when things are going wrong, there's some larger logic which is going to guide them back, which isn't true. And it makes you vulnerable to shock. Less so if you're an immigrant or an African-American, or there are other exceptions to this, big important ones. But if you believe that everything is going to go well, then you're shocked when things don't go well. And being shocked then becomes an excuse not to do stuff, right? So that's the problem with inevitability. When you lose faith in inevitability, you tend to drop into what I call the politics of eternity, which is Putin or which is Trump, where all the good stuff is in the past. And the problem is what you should do is cycle back to the past. Imagine when we were great, try to make us great again. And in that view, we're all innocent. The bad people are guilty, the immigrants, the black people, or for Putin, the Ukrainians, whatever, the West. And then politics is just about telling a story about our greatness and our innocence. And that too is really, really disabling, because if we're going to be free, we have to be able to imagine lots of futures and not be cycled back into an imagined past.
One of the things, and this gets to my current dilemma with the politics of today, is that we have fetishized the Constitution. We believe that because certain compromises were made for reasons that are totally inapt to our society, that things must be the way they are. Well, we have the Electoral College because it must be the way it is. It's in the Constitution. Mm-hmm. So it is an excuse for a failure of imagination. You don't have to make an argument, should we have the Electoral College, if your answer is we must have it because it's there. How do we get people to really embrace what you call agency? That, yes, we inherit certain things, but we are also human beings who have the right to alter them. The worst example of this is originalism, this myth in judicial interpretation that you have to go back and get in the mind of, you know, the founding fathers, and that's the only way the law can have legitimacy. Talk to us a little bit about how we break free of that.
All right, I'm going to take that up. I got first to fix just an asterisk to it, because I think, and then you know this very well, I think in some sense that the situation is worse and more radical than that, because the originalists are just kidding.
Yes.
Like, it would be one thing if they were making a serious effort and
reading. They're not even trying now.
But they're faking it, and they're just making stuff up. Right. And, you know, they're not just saying the Constitution stops us from doing things. They're saying, well, parts of the Constitution don't even exist anymore. Like, I'll just take an article which happens to be, you know, the 14th Amendment. I'll just pretend it's not there. Okay, so end of asterisk.
Yes.
To me, that's important because the whole originalism thing can, it ends up like, it seems to land at a kind of narcissism and a form of creative writing, which is kind of where we are. Okay. So I make a point in the first chapter of the book. So the book starts with the definition of freedom, which we've talked about a little bit. It lands on government. And the notion is that freedom justifies a certain kind of government. And in the middle, as you've kindly already mentioned, there are these forms of freedom. The first one is sovereignty. Solidarity, you already mentioned at the end. The first one is sovereignty. And I make this point. I say, okay, why exactly is a political system justified to, say, a baby who has just been born? Like, what exactly is it about the 18th century or any other social contract, real or imaginary, that binds itself on a baby who has just been born? Why is that? I don't believe it personally. I think a government is justified insofar as that government creates the conditions for that baby to grow up and to be a free person. I think that is the right, that is, I believe, the correct answer. That's what government is for. It's not that the government is sovereign. I think that's bogus mysticism. I think that people should become sovereign in the sense that they should know what their emotions are, be able to control themselves, know how to interact with other people, have a sense of the world around them, the past. And those ingredients help us to become free, and that's all that matters, honestly. Like, that's it. That's the alpha and the omega. That's it. Government is there to make that possible. So it's not the government that's sovereign. The government is there to make us sovereign. So when we evaluate the Constitution, I mean, I think we should say something like, in the 18th century, some of that stuff was pretty radical. And if we're going to be pretty radical, what would we do, right? Like, if we take this whole freedom thing seriously, let's think it 2.5 centuries forward. Let's be radical the way they were. I'm copying Frederick Douglass, by the way. This was his point long ago. They were radical in their time. We have to be radical in our time. And so the whole notion that some creaky thing, which was created 2.5 centuries ago, would be everything, that was actually foreign to the founders. They didn't think that way.
Yes. Right?
That wasn't their idea. But I would say something which is even deeper, which is that if the government's justified, it's justified in terms of creating the conditions of freedom for the generation that's just been born. That is, you know, I argue this out at length in the book, but I think that's where you have to start.
Right. It sort of amuses me, I guess, or terrifies me, that when you start thinking that, as you say, it has to be the way it is, you stop analyzing problems that exist today. You don't ask, well, you know, what system should we use for electing the president? I sometimes think the founders would have, you know, been either horrified or cracked up if they said, you're still using the Electoral College? My gosh, we put in the amendment process. What's the matter with you people? Why have you stuck to this? What do you think can generate some agency, some momentum, so that people do not fall back on these totems, whether it's the Constitution, whether it's always been there, it's always the way it's done? What's the formula for breaking free of this?
Yeah, I mean, free is the word, right? Like, this is why I start with, this is why the book is about freedom.
Because
freedom is about all the things you really care about. And it's about actually being able to balance them in your own life and bring some of them into the world. That's what freedom actually is. It isn't something written 2.5 centuries ago. It isn't some empty phrase. It isn't a cliche to keep you down. That's what freedom actually is. And if we are free people, then we're going to think the way that you're advocating that we think. And so I think we have to start with the freedom part. What would it really mean to be a land of the free? And then I think some of the rest of this stuff starts to take care of itself. And so here, I mean, partly because I'm talking to you, I will just say that, like, this is, I think, a lost conservative point, which is that analysis has to include norms. That's a neutral way of putting it. Analysis, in my view, also the most conservative possible way, it has to include virtues. Okay. Like, if I'm going to analyze something, I can't just say I'm describing it neutrally. Right? I'm thinking about the way America should be. I'm thinking about what it would be like if things were better. And that better has to include some value affirmations. And so as the right in America has dropped values and value pluralism, I'm sad to say, in their honorable exceptions, but in general, what's happened is that the right has dropped both values and value pluralism in the name of believing in tall tales told by an absolute leader. as we've made that move, there's something to pick up here, which is that, okay, conservatives are right that there are values, but liberals are also right that those values are many and they clash and contradict. And then the social democrats are right that you need to have structures in place so that people can grow up, learn what those values are, and learn to juggle them, right? And so you can pick up these kind of lost treasures from all over the political map and come up with something which is much better and, in my view, true.
One of the other things you offer, I think, a really interesting critique of is capitalism itself, that during the Cold War, we pitted capitalism against communism. And the assumption was, if you get rid of the, controlled state and throw that off, you're going to have unbridled capitalism and everyone is going to be better. And instead we get Putin. Tell us why sort of this capitalism-communism duality didn't turn out, and really what it should tell us about ways in which we have to modify capitalism.
I appreciate your saying, and instead we got Putin, because it is important. There is a really, and it goes back to your passivity question, there is a deeply held American view that so long as it's capitalist, eventually it's going to sort itself out. And Russia and China tell us a different story. Big, powerful, capitalist dictatorships. There are other things going on besides capitalism, but the very fact that other things are going on besides capitalism tells us that capitalism doesn't liberate everything. That capitalism can't do the work on its own, which is something I think we need to learn. So in terms of the Cold War, a couple things going on here. One is that I think, interestingly and rightly, during the Cold War, engaged with the rest of the world and learned something about the rest of the world. And so there were generations who are now passing who engaged with Marxism and who had thoughts about Marxism and who, interestingly, tried to think about how capitalism could best succeed alongside Marxism. And that could take the form of Keynesianism or it could take the, but the idea is that communism is a challenge and therefore we have to make capitalism better by making it less like the communists say it is. We have to break the boom and bust cycle. We have to help the least fortunate and so on. And that style of thinking was helpful. It made people free. It also made the United States a more free country than it would have been otherwise. So I want to note that. At the end of the Cold War, though, we got ourselves onto a kind of mechanistic way of seeing things, which was that capitalism itself was an agent. Capitalism isn't an agent. Like, markets are social institutions that we create and modify. They do useful work, but at the end, their shape is up to us. But by the Reagan years, we got to this idea that, like, it was capitalism doing the work against communism doing the work. And that's a fatal mistake, because capitalism isn't going to help you out. Capitalism can't do anything for you. There is all the isms that don't have a person at the beginning of them, I think, are highly, highly suspect on their own. And then in the early post-Cold War world, we fell into this inevitability problem, which you mentioned earlier, which went something like this. Since fascism was defeated and since communism has failed, we know the only alternative is liberal democracy. And look, capitalism is going to do work for us. So it's siesta time on political thinking. It's siesta time on political theory. It's siesta time on history. It's siesta time on the humanities. All this stuff about values in the past, it doesn't matter anymore, because we know that there are no alternatives and a faceless force out there is going to bring us all the good things. And I'm just going to point out a kind of irony here, which is that was what Marx thought.
Yes.
I mean, that's
history, magical forces.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, like, whether you think it's the existence of private property or the abolition of private property, which is going to do the work for you, you're still in the same determinist worldview, right? You're still advocating basically a project of unfreedom, where you say that the right technical modification to the modes of production is going to make us free. No, it ain't. Either way, that's not the answer.
In some ways, it makes, I think properly so, FDR the ultimate conservator of capitalism. Bold, persistent reform. Bold, persistent experimentation. Mm-hmm. I think sets a model for us. I'm curious, as you have begun to talk to people about the book, Are people resistant to your thesis? Are people arguing with you? Or has there been sort of a light bulb phenomenon that people say, yes, that's how we got to where we are? Or has it been both?
I'm at the very beginning, but so far it's been all light bulb. Right. But it's been kind of maybe a brighter, more distant
right.
about, because the light bulb has been, wait a minute, we could actually think about freedom.
Yes.
As opposed to just kind of bandying it about. And the kind of ashamed part of it is, which I do hear, oh, freedom actually means something.
Yes.
Yeah. Like that ball dropping, like, oh, wait, Professor Schneider, you're telling us that you take this seriously and that it really does mean something. And then you kind of start having the interesting conversation after that.
Yeah.
So it's come in that kind of light bulb that, hey, wait a minute, maybe there is a word that actually has a concept and that concept could take us somewhere. That's been it so far.
And I think in some ways, if people are resistant, it's because ultimately you're saying, you got to do some work. This is my argument about citizenship, freedom. This is not a passive spectator sport kind of thing. Mm-hmm. You think it's just going to run without you? Well, you know, there are a lot of bad folks out there who have different ideas about how society is going to run. So it does put responsibility with individuals and with groups to act. When you come to the end of the book and you describe a world in which people are more free than they are, I found it a very compelling story and very much like, actually, just to be political for a moment, Kamala Harris's agenda. Describe a little bit what a freer America would look like, because I think people have problems even imagining what would make them freer or what more free would look like.
Thank you for that, because it really does have a lot to do with imagination. And sometimes we dismiss imagination itself as being the thing which isn't real, but without imagination, you can't change reality. I mean, you have to know how things work, of course, but if you think the way things work now is the only way things can work, then you're missing a whole lot of reality. I mean, history is just full of moments where there were all kinds of possibilities, including possibilities that people didn't see at the time. And I think that's how we have to understand every moment, that it's rich in possibilities, both bad and good, that we can't really see. And for me, going all the way back to the root and talking about freedom as a way, I mean, I'm trying to make an argument about what freedom actually is. And I'm trying to help us feel that kind of positive friction in the world, which I think is the first step towards having a freer form of engagement with other people, and therefore a society where freedom is more possible. But I'm also trying to shake things up so that we can imagine a different world. So that the device of the book is that I started in 1976 in the bicentennial when I was a child and when I was ringing a bell. And I end in 2076 or an imagined 2076 where we have gotten some things right. And in that world, which I think is possible, Ukraine has won the war. We've shifted from hydrocarbons. Social media is under control. Americans are living much longer lives, which seems to me to be important. I mean, anticipating ill health and death does not make you freer. And being dead doesn't make you freer either. I mean, there's this weird American notion that if you die pointlessly, that means you live in a freer country. I don't get it. I mean, Canadians live 5 years longer. That seems like a good idea, you know, to me, frankly. And we would be calmer because we'd be less concerned about the fate of our children or the fate of our parents. We would have more time to develop ourselves into being the kind of people who we want to be and who we dare not, in our present America, imagine that we could be. So it would be a world where the outside was more predictable, but the inside was less predictable, you know, where there was less to fear in our country and more to explore about ourselves. And I think that's within reach. Like, this is a really important thing. Like, we're trapped because we don't have the ideas right. And we don't have the ideas right. We can't imagine anything except the status quo, or sometimes the status quo breaking into something much worse. Whereas to get out of the status quo and even to defend ourselves, I think we have to be able to imagine something which is much better. And that much better is definitely possible.
Well, I can't think of a better note to end on than that. It is a wonderful book. And as I said when we began, it takes thinking. You have to go slow, you have to go back, you have to reread, you have to think of the examples you're putting forth. And what better recommendation can you give to a book that it makes you think? So thank you for writing it. Thank you for all the work on democracy and tyranny that you did. And good luck with the book.
Thank you very much. Glad we could talk.
We've all tried tons of ways to feel good after a night of drinks. There are all sorts of hokey urban legends that don't work. But I found a science-backed product that actually does. It's a pre-alcohol probiotic drink from the brand ZBiotics. Their probiotic was invented by PhD scientists to tackle rough mornings after drinking. Here's how it works. When you drink, alcohol gets converted into a toxic byproduct in the guts. It's that byproduct, not dehydration, that's to blame for your rough next day. ZBiotics are pre-alcohol. They produce an enzyme that breaks this byproduct down, giving you a proactive solution that wards off feeling miserable the next day instead of a reactive approach, like drinking electrolytes or eating greasy food. As a working journalist in Washington, D.C., nights are sometimes filled with trips to the bar, I admit it. Throw in a great nightlife and it all adds up. That's why I first gave ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink a try. A night before a big appearance, a night before a big show, a night before a important piece is due, well, you have to be up and going. And I was amazed how great I felt the next day. I knocked out my story. I showed up on time for my speech. I did a great show. That's what happens when you use ZBiotics. I'm more energized and excited for a busy work and fall social season, and their pre-alcohol can keep you living your best life. After hearing about pre-alcohol and wondering what it was actually like, I've tried it. And now I get why everyone is talking about it. With their GMO technology, ZBiotics is continuing to invent probiotics that will help with everyday challenges of modern living. How do you get it? Go to zbiotics.com/greenroom to learn more and get 15% off your first order when you use greenroom at checkout. ZBiotics is backed with a 100% money-back guarantee. So if you're unsatisfied for any reason, they'll refund your money. No questions asked. Remember, head to zbiotics.com/greenroom and use the code GREENROOM at checkout for 15% off. Thank you, ZBiotics, for sponsoring this episode and our good times. You can find the link in the show notes. And that was Timothy Snyder. I told you, it takes thinking. You have to really kind of ponder these things. So what were the big ideas that I think Tim drew out of us? One is that this takes work. We cannot allow other people to vote. We cannot allow other people to decide what our Constitution should look like in the 21st century, either dead or alive. There's no magic to keeping the Constitution exactly the way it is, that we have agency, and that agency demands that we think. One of the things we didn't touch on as much as I would have liked in the time we had is Tim makes the really good point that we've gotten dumber and duller because we're so addicted to social media that we're passive. Everyone has their head in their phone, and they don't have time to read, they don't have time to engage, they don't have time to think. And this is a recipe for authoritarianism. Authoritarians love it when you're out to lunch, when you're busy with something else, when you're amusing yourself with nonsense. So I think one of the lessons is freedom takes work, freedom takes imagination, freedom takes personal responsibility. I think another interesting point that he makes, again, that's extremely relevant to where we are now, is that we need to start thinking not of smaller or bigger government, government's good, government's bad, but what is government doing? Is it doing the things that we want? And we see that Donald Trump and the MAGA folks, their goal is to discredit all of government. by saying it's always a negative, it never works, they're not supplying you with hurricane relief, they're not telling you the truth about all these other things. That is a noxious recipe. First of all, it's attacking objective reality. And secondly, it's telling you that if you just get rid of all this government regulation, you'll be free. No, he'll be freer, but the rest of us will be sicker, more endangered, dumber, less mobile, and a whole bunch of other negative things. So when you hear people bemoaning not only a specific fault of government, which we should, government is there to be critiqued, and that's part of what we do as a free people, is look at it, analyze it, improve it. But if you're making an argument that government is inherently bad, that we have to completely change the entire map, be wary, because those people may be looking to advance their own freedom, but not yours, because we actually do need government. And it's a terrible idea to think we should go back in history, whether it's Clarence Thomas saying we should consider women's rights in the 19th century when the 14th Amendment was passed and women were essentially still property in most of America. It's a mistake to go backwards and say we should go back to the pre-New Deal state. What, we were freer when we had child poverty? We were freer when people were living in poverty? I don't think so. And of course, their big one is we were freer when we were whiter and more Christian. Really? Really? Well, first of all, you're excluding other people from enjoying freedom, which is part of the American dream. You're saying it's only for us, no one else can possess it, which is wrong and selfish. And secondly, you deny all of the contributions to freedom that immigrants have made. Whether it's the internet, whether it's music that you enjoy, whether it's scientific advances, all of these things that immigrants have contributed have made improvements in our lives, have made us freer, smarter, more mobile, more healthy. And excluding them makes us less free. So you begin to see the pattern of the lies and of the destructiveness of a movement like MAGA, which seeks to obliterate truth, which seeks to turn people against one another and against the very idea of government. And it's important, as Kamala Harris has done, to say, no, we need a new way forward. The future, not the past, is going to determine what kind of people we are. Yes, we want to import our values. We want to have our lessons from history. We want to have certain constitutional rights and structures, but we don't have to settle for less. We can ask more of ourselves and more of government. And I think put in that way, you can understand how an election can be joyous, because it's an opportunity to say, here it is. Here's our chance to do something different. Here's our chance to determine our future. And that's really what democracy offers us. So quite a conversation with Tim. And you and your friends can find us wherever you get your podcasts. Bye-bye.